As you know, we get our speakers because of personal contact from our members or somebody on the wait list. And I'm glad to tell you that Dave Rissmiller has done it again. And speaking of Dave Rissmiller, he is vice president this year. Next year he'll be president-elect and then president. And you'll get to see a lot more of Dave next Friday when we have the 25th anniversary celebration, because Dave is going to be the moderator, sitting between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, keeping them separated, and also fielding questions from the audience. So that's going to be an exciting thing. Please welcome Dave Rissmiller to introduce our speaker. Dave.
Thanks, President Wade. Dr. Tom, we have our work cut out for us following that wonderful group of students from the high school, so I'm sure you will rise to the occasion. Fellow members and guests, it's a real privilege for me to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Thomas Honig, President, Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. I was on the wrong page there for a minute, Tom. I promoted you. Well, I'm talking the microphone, and we'll do the best we can. Most of you have seen his bio, so I do not want to repeat and read from that bio. I'd like to just a couple things I want to remind you of. Number one, Tom's MBA and PhD is from Iowa State University. And I next want to say that he started with the Fed in 1973 out of school as an economist and has been there ever since. Another thing you should know is Tom was very active in the bank supervision area during the banking crises of the 1980s during those problems. And for your information, the Kansas City Fed covers a great deal of geography, branches in Denver, Omaha, and Oklahoma City. So it's pretty widespread in the middle of the country. Moving on from the bio, in 1991, Tom became president of the Federal Reserve Bank. He was age 45, and at that time, the youngest president of that Federal Reserve Bank in the bank's history. First day on the job as president, he attended his first FOMC meeting, Federal Open Market Committee meeting. I imagine that was quite an experience. Federal Reserve System established in 1913, banks chartered in 1914, and Tom is only the eighth president of that Federal Reserve Bank since the bank was chartered. He is the only president of that bank that started out, I'll say, as a college graduate trainee, because I understand that term, and rose through the ranks to the level of president. He is the longest serving of the 12 district Federal Reserve banks. He is the longest serving president of the banks. He is the senior member of the FOMC, Federal Open Market Committee. And as you may know, this is the committee that sets national policy, national monetary policy. And I think this last year maybe the Fed has tampered a little bit in fiscal policy as well. He won't be able to say anything about that. Each year in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, the Kansas City Fed, since 1978, hosts what is referred to as the Global Banking Economic Symposium. Tom is the host for that with the Federal Reserve Bank, and of course the Fed chairman is a speaker, but the important thing is central bankers from around the world and economists are the attendees at that symposium. Tom has become not only a national but international outspoken speaker on such issues as too big to fail, banking regulation, executive compensation, and I'm sure we're going to hear a little bit about that, his opinions on those issues. In a 2002 meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, I want to read what was said that is remembered very well by many people. He expressed his concerns that extremely low interest rates at that time were setting up future imbalance for the nation's economy. Setting up for the future imbalance in the nation's economy. Now, what happened after 2002? This man has done very, very well in handing out some key phrases about what's been going on in our country's economy. I'm going to give you one last quote from our guest speaker. Last week, quoted in the Wall Street Journal, I'm going to read it word for word. I think the economy is starting its recovery, and there is reason to be optimistic. With that said, on a positive note, I want you to help me welcome today's speaker to the Forum Club. Tom?
Well, thank you very much, Dave. I will say, David, most people don't acknowledge or have themselves acknowledge as inviting me to a program until after it's over and they see how it turns out. So I admire your courage. I also want to say to our wonderful students, you're much more impressive in high school than I was. But I was a little disappointed that not one of you even mentioned the economics profession. I hate to tell you how bad a times we're having in the economics profession right now, but I can't get one student to say anything about it. But I'm impressed. I'm impressed with the students. I do speak around the country and often do speak to students as well, and I am always rejuvenated when I do that, because people say the United States, we're in the last throes of our great power and so forth, and whenever I meet our students, I know differently, and certainly today is no exception. So congratulations to all these wonderful students here. There is one other rule that I set out in these days before I speak, and that is I'm going to be fairly candid with you, and there is a rule that I have. You may not shoot the messenger. You may only question him. And I do want to leave time for questions for you. My goal today is to kind of give you a sense of the economy and then spend a little more time on the issues of policy that we have, broadly speaking, we have to face as a nation, not just me as a member of the Federal Open Market Committee, but we as a nation going forward from here. And then I am going to speak a little bit about some issues around our financial system and things that need to be addressed over the course of the next several months or a couple of years. So let me start. Obviously, we have gone through a very difficult time. A year ago, I think most people in this country did think things were bleak, my word. And in the first quarter, we were losing jobs at about 700,000 a month on average. Just a tremendously difficult period. As part of, though, the reaction to that, both the central bank and the government pumped enormous stimulus into the economy. And things were actually beginning to stabilize in the second quarter, and we actually, as we know now, had a positive national income or gross domestic product in the third quarter, and we will have a fairly good national income or gross domestic product in the fourth quarter. So things are beginning to improve, and I want to talk about that. But what that brings forward is the most difficult part of the cycle for me as a policymaker and others, because it is at that time that the decisions become most delicate. You have to think about the long run. You have to take your mind off the immediate, off the crisis, and begin to think a little bit longer term and the trade-offs that are involved in those choices that have to be made. So that's really the main part, and then I do want to, as I say, talk a little bit about other issues in financial structuring. Now, as we look at 2010, and we come out of 2009, there is some momentum. The data are mixed. But we know that the fourth quarter will probably be stronger than the third quarter. The other part of it is, extremely important, is to realize that as we come into 2010, there is an enormous amount of stimulus still in play, and that will boost the economy through the course of the year. About half of the overall fiscal stimulus that was approved a year ago is to be spent in this year. And with that, and the fact that interest rates, the policy rates we have, are near zero, we know that liquidity is being poured into the economy almost on a daily basis. So with that, you begin to see that there is the possibility for improvement, as we've seen in this in the third and the fourth quarter. Now, going forward, then, I think that we will see GDP. Most economists are thinking it will be between 2.5% and 3%. And what Dave was quoting for me a little earlier is I'm a little more optimistic than that because of the amount of stimulus in play. I think it could be somewhere between 3 and 3.5%. And it would be good for all of us if it were, because that would help with the job market more quickly. Now, that's driven importantly by the stimulus, but there are some other things now that can take place. First of all, and importantly, is the self, if you will, correcting process of economies, of the U.S. economy, but the global economy. And that's extremely important. Because we are seeing the rest of the world's economy begin to strengthen, especially Asia, and we've seen that in the demand for our exports, which is critically important to our ability to sustain a recovery. And that's really very good news as we move forward. The second is that that we are seeing inventory adjustments. We are seeing the fact that manufacturing is picking up as inventories have been worked off. And that has a momentum of its own because you see those jobs in that sector decline more slowly or actually improve over the course of the year. I suspect we will. And then that begins to add some momentum. Now, of course, a critical element of all this in the United States still is the consumer. The consumer, over a long period of time, has represented two-thirds of our national income, and in recent years, because of their use of leverage, has been even higher than that. And we have this 10% unemployment. But if we have some strength from the manufacturing sector, and it begins to change the psychology, continues to change the psychology, then we could see that sector grow more quickly and employment begin to rise. Now, unemployment will come down very slowly, but employment begin to rise, and the consumer will come back in as personal incomes grow, and we've seen personal incomes begin to grow. Now, that's a very delicate area as well, because we know, as economists, that the United States savings rate, personal savings rate, has been near zero. It fell from some years ago from as high as 10% of income down to zero. And we know that if we're going to have an economy that sustains itself, that we have to have our own savings. It has to come up, but we don't want it to come up too quickly. Because if it does, then that will impede the recovery. So there's a very delicate balance there, but I think right now the personal savings rate is about 4 to 4.5%. If that continues and personal incomes rise, then the consumer will be back in play. We've seen consumer confidence go up. Now, some of the numbers this morning were disappointing, but that is always the way recoveries works. Well, and I'll come back to that in just a second. So the consumer is a very significant part. There is uncertainty about that, but on balance, we're seeing improvement there, and that'll be important in carrying the economy forward. And I think the consumer will watch very carefully and react to the stimulus that is in place as well. Now, things that can add to that is if we do see the investment side of the economy, because corporate balance sheets are not in bad shape despite this recession, and interest rates are very low, so if our investment side picks up, that'll strengthen the economy even further, and that could be a very strong. If the rest of the world also improves, our export demand well as our import, but our export demand would increase and we could actually see a stronger economy grow. Now, that means that we're starting this recovery, and I think we've been in the recovery for since the third quarter. And I think that is what we have to keep our mind on from a policy point of view. Because we have been working on a crisis over the last year, the immediate, the now, the instant. Policy has been incredibly accommodated because of that. Zero interest rates. Now we have to begin to look down the road, and we can't wait until we're absolutely sure that everything is back working. Because if we do that, then we delay removal of this very significant stimulus, and in some ways excess stimulus, if it stays too long. Now, there'll be a series of arguments in the public, and I think in the policy realm around that. There is a very strong motivation. We all have it. And that is to look at that unemployment rate and say, we need to wait until that's down. We have to. And that has a very appealing, because you also say there's excess capacity in the economy. There is no immediate sign of inflation in the economy, and therefore we should wait and delay. And that's appealing. It's appealing to me. It's appealing to a broad base. But there is the other side of that. And the other side is important as well. And that is, when you start a recovery, it is almost never for sure that it is going to grow quickly, that the economy is going to grow quickly. And if you wait for assurance, you will be well down the road in terms of the stimulus that you put in play and the difficulty withdrawing that without consequence, as we've, I think, learned from past experience. And so we need to begin now to think about how we deal with the fiscal stimulus and the deficit and the debt. And we need to begin to think now about monetary policy and how you take it from zero, not to a tight policy by any means, but off of zero to still an accommodative policy as we come through this, but not so much that we risk the introducing instability into the economy. That's the challenges. On the fiscal side, it is a dramatic challenge. And it's important to me from a monetary policy point of view because it will impact the pressures that we will see in monetary policy in the years to come. The deficit last year, most people in this room know this, was about $1.5 trillion, a record by any measure. And it will be, again, near that large this fiscal year. Now, when you take that deficit and you say, what's the total debt? The total debt in the United States will soon surpass our gross domestic product, which is about $14 trillion plus. Now, that's the debt level, not the deficit, the debt level that has to be serviced. And we all know that that means over time that begins to become increasingly a pressure. Now, that means the government has to borrow. And as the economy begins to improve, the private sector will need to borrow, and there will be upward pressure on interest rates. And it's at that point that the authority, the desire, the pressure will be for, if the Federal Reserve, the central bank, would just keep interest rates low, then we wouldn't see interest rates rise and the economy could continue to grow. But of course, artificially holding down those interest rates is called monetizing the debt. It means you are now using the printing press to buy the public debt, and the outcome in history has been over and over again inflation. Not today, but 3 or 4 years from now, depending on what fiscal policymakers do and how monetary policymakers react to that and act themselves. That's going to be even more complicated in the year ahead, because two things are going to happen in 2011. We're going to see the phase out of the stimulus plan, and the Bush tax cuts are going to end. So you're going to see contractionary pressure on the economy, and it is going to be desperately unpopular for politics or anyone else to try and bring the deficit in line and allow these things to expire. So it is a major effort. And what we need to think about is how we're going to deal with that now as the economy improves and not when it's right upon us. And there's a couple things there. That means there's going to be a need to think about the sacrifice involved, either by spending cuts or tax increases or some combination of the two, none of which will be popular. And that's why that is such a daunting task ahead. And it's going to be more difficult because we won't get that accomplished, and yet, unless there is a sense of shared sacrifice in this country, which we have not had for some time. So that's a major policy issue in front of us as Americans. Now, the issues around monetary policy are every bit as daunting as those around fiscal policy. We are in a very accommodative position, and yet the economy and unemployment, the economy is recovering slowly and unemployment remains high. And yet interest rates are zero. So how do we deal with that? As I said, there'll be those who argue, yes, we should hold off on that. Wait until we're for sure. And of course, the risk around that is that you invite future inflation and perhaps new kinds of bubbles that we can't even anticipate now. And what we have to remember about monetary policy, I tell people, is that, first of all, it's a tool, but it has to be used properly, like any tool. Now, there's elements of a cyclical downturn that monetary policy can't address. Cyclical unemployment, but structural unemployment is something monetary policy cannot deal with. If you've had a period where enormous resources have been put into the housing market, more than what was needed at the time, the reallocation of the resources are the pain we have to go through. And monetary, if you try and use monetary policy to not have to incur that, then you risk the instability in the future. Secondly, having interest rates, policy interest rates near zero, I think interferes with the credit process. Because if you are in a banking industry where you can borrow from the Fed, or you have excess reserves that receive a return, or you have to pay very little and go up the yield curve and invest in treasuries or whatever else for very little risk, credit risk, what are you going to do? You have a guaranteed return, guaranteed spread. So we know that there are other just practical reasons why it has to come up in time. And thirdly, holding interest rates down at near zero is a factor that disallocates resources. Zero interest rates subsidize borrowers, penalize savers. Exactly a major issue. It tends to push credit to projects that would otherwise not be done, therefore not as sound, and therefore you create instability from that. And we have to remember that as we think about moving from the immediate, that is dealing with the crisis, which we had to do, to now beginning to think of the longer term implications for the economy. And so those are the challenges from a policy point of view that affect all of us. And one of the things I encourage people when they say yes, it's this, that they think it through pretty carefully before we make the choices that are ours to make here fairly soon. The final thing I want to mention to you before we open it up for questions, and I think I'm right on time, is around the financial structure in the system. There's a lot of talk about reorganizing the regulators. You may have opinions on that and so forth, but I keep telling those who will listen and those in the Congress, focus on the right thing. It isn't rearranging the deck chairs that matters. It's how we take this future structure forward. And there's three things that I think are important from my perspective. The first thing is, yes, there were a lot of mistakes made in the supervision realm, no question, and in listening to the testimony on this research committee, it's obvious. But the fact of the matter is, this country went through a period where the markets solve all. The markets will take care of it. But I tell people, even in rugby, you have rules. It can be rough and tumble, but you have rules. And we have to come back to basics. And I call it rules that are simple, understandable, and enforceable. I don't mean a bureaucracy that is so convoluted that you can't figure out what the rule is, but simple, understandable, and enforceable. For example, leverage. That is debt to support your assets. If you have a leverage ratio of 12 to 1, or maybe 14 to 1, that's a fairly leveraged institution, financial institution or otherwise. When Bear Stearns went down, it was 34 to 1. It's outrageous. And there were no rules that set that firmly in place, a limit. And they say, well, it inhibits growth. And the answer to the question is, or the answer to that comment is, yes, it does. It's countercyclical. When the boom comes and everyone's enthusiastic, that puts a cap. That makes it sensible again. So that's number one. Underwriting standards. We used to have in the law loan-to-value ratios that were mandatory, 80%. Now, that's not 110%, which you can grow from, but it's sensible. And around liquidity, when you're borrowing all of it short-term and then investing in a long-term commercial real estate, you're asking for trouble. And rules would help impede that enthusiasm at the height of the boom. So that's number one. Number two, we need to deal with the issue of too big to fail. That is, the inability of the largest institutions to be allowed to fail. if they deserve to be. Not because they're large, but if they made the decisions. Because in my part of the world, in the Midwest, banks fail. They're taken over. They're liquidated. They're sold. They pay the consequences. Capitalism works. That's what capitalism is. Opportunity, risk, success, failure, renewal. And when you don't have that, you create inefficiencies, and we're seeing that today. And what you really get are the desires and incentives to micromanage the financial system by politicians or others, or regulators. None of it healthy. So we have to do that. Now, to mitigate the possibilities of that failure, of course, because we don't want failure, to mitigate that is not only the rules, but the fact that, yes, in the banking industry, we need to go back, not go back necessarily completely to Glass-Steagall, but we need to take the gambling opportunities out, because commercial banks have the payment system. That is how you and I and move transactions across this country. It's very serious responsibility, and they should have that. And they're the intermediaries. So they need to have some activities, that is, trading for their own account substantial amounts. If, for example, a large institution in this country, and we're in a and they find themselves in a discussion about a $100 million bonus for a trader, $100 million bonus means they made billions, which means they were in an open speculative position, which means they could have lost it. And that means the taxpayer would have picked it up. They wouldn't have got the $100 million. They didn't get to share the $100 million bonus, but they would have gotten to share the loss. So we have to remove that from the most important segment of our financial system, the commercial banking industry. And then I think we begin to deal with issues more effectively around too big to fail. So there are lots of things ahead of us from a policy point of view and monetary policy, from a policy point of view and structure and how the financial industry works. We can address them successfully, but it will take dialogue. It will take, sure, some compromise, but it will most certainly take commitment to make things different. So I'm going to end with that because we want to open it up for questions, so thank you very much.
Tom, given your competent and reasoned presentation, that just gives all of us greater confidence in the Federal Reserve System.
It could use some confidence.
David has gone through scores and scores of questions, some of them from our student guest, and he's boiled down that to the essential few. Okay. So I'll turn it back over to Dave.
Thank you.
Dave, there you go.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you, Wade. A lot of questions, and I've tried to sort them into several piles, and we'll answer as many as we can, but unfortunately we won't be able to get through all of them, but I thank you for bringing forth so many questions. First question is, could you please explain for us the Federal Reserve District Banks and the Federal Reserve Board of Governors and the relation of those, the establishment of those, and how they operate today? This is easy.
Banks, Federal Reserve Banks, good. No, it's you know, the Federal Reserve System is actually the third attempt at a central bank in the United States. The first two were monolithic institutions that were even distrusted more than the Federal Reserve among the populace, and therefore their charters were allowed to lapse. So when they came to put this together, they had two things in mind. Should it be a public or a private, and should it be a single institution or multiple? And the debates, as always, led to the compromise. And what you have is the Board of Governors, who are led by Ben Bernanke, and there's at full force there's seven, and they're the regulatory and the oversight for the Federal Reserve System broadly. They are appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate. They're a federal agency. The 12 banks were designed first of all, give broad representation. They did not want the central bank to be just in Washington or just on Wall Street. The populist, of which I'm one, would not stand for that. They wanted broader input into the policy since it affected them. And so they had 12 banks established from Boston, New York, all the way to San Francisco, with local boards of directors, people who are, yes, local bankers, but also business, agriculture, labor are on those boards. And they select the president, subject to the veto of the Board of Governors, the political appointees, And it's all about checks and balances. And that's why you have these 12 banks. You have input from all over the country and the communication back, and you have the Board of Governors, and you do have a New York Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street. And it gives a much more diverse go, and it also helps insulate the central bank from the political issues. Because if you have the spending with the printing press, you get Argentina. No offense to Argentina. They're very good friends of ours. But at the same time, you want that separate. And that's why so much issues are around whether the Federal Reserve should have fiscal, any kind of role in fiscal policy. And the answer is absolutely not.
Follow-on question relates to pressure right now from some congressional members on what the role of the Federal Reserve System should be. There seems to be a number of congressional members that want to regulate, audit, do a lot of different things with the Fed than it has been doing since it was formed. Would you please comment?
Well, the answer to that is, in times of crisis, that almost always becomes an issue. Because an independent central bank makes decisions, and they're not all popular, so you do get a reaction to that. And one of those, as you well know, is Ron Paul. And for those of you who are libertarians, I have a lot of respect for him. He has called it Audit the Fed. If you actually look at the bill and if you read his book is titled End the Fed. And I don't agree with that. I would ask you to think about how you would deal with a financial crisis, a global financial crisis, without a central bank of the United States. You might get through it, but I think it would have been even more difficult. So those pressures are normal. I don't take offense at them at all. I've testified. I feel very comfortable doing it. We have made errors. There is no one on earth who hasn't. But we have pretty much, at this point, done a great deal. But the hard decisions still lie ahead. And I think that's what we're focused on and what we should be focused on. And I think Congress has to sort it out, and that's fair. We are accountable to Congress. We're insulated so we can make decisions, but we are accountable, and I think we should step up to it, and that's what we're going to do.
Okay, next we have a student question I'd like to bring to your attention. It regards the stimulus package and opinion of the stimulus package, what it was enough, too big or too small, and then has it done its job?
Well, the stimulus package, you won't know whether it was too big, too small for some time. It certainly was sizable. So I think it has a real good chance of doing its job, a very good chance. Now, there's also issues around the stimulus. In economics, there's this concept of a multiplier. And a dollar of government spending can have a less than one multiplier or a more than one, and there's a lot of debate on whether this is really greater than one, and only time will tell. But there is a lot of it that is related to transfer payments, transfers to local governments, state governments. That probably has a very small multiplier because their spending otherwise would be going down more sharply, so it's keeping it there. There's minimal on infrastructure, which has the largest multiplier. So those are things that people have chosen to make because of the hardships of unemployment and so forth. But I think it certainly has had its effect, and perhaps not all the intended effect, but certainly a good portion of the intended effect. Now the issue is you can only do that for so long and so much because we do have, as a result, $1.5 trillion deficit, another one. Estimates are $9 trillion over 10 years. That's probably low. And so we have to face up to that. So, yes, it had its effect, but now we got to think of tomorrow, or these students will have less of a standard of living than we've been able to enjoy.
Next question, again, kind of follows where you just ended up, and it's talking about the deficit and how we finance it over the years to come, and will Japan and China keep buying our debt? That's kind of a combination of what several of you have asked about.
The deficit is a huge issue for us. We need to come to grips with it, and the Congress needs to begin to turn to that in a productive way. Talk about opportunity for town hall meetings. This is what I think could spend their time well at, explaining it, how we're going to deal with it, because The unfunded liability from Social Security and Medicare, without even talking about the health care package, is enormous. I mean, it's trillions of dollars. So we have to begin to do that, and sooner rather than later, if we're going to be successful in being able to handle that. Now, if you don't, I'll just give you a couple things to think about. To fund just the Social Security and Medicare in about 25 years, maybe a little longer depending on how the actuaries work, the marginal tax rate would have to be 85%. So, or you're going to have to borrow a lot more money. Now, the problem with that is, you think taxes are debilitating, but borrowing is too, especially as the economy grows. Because if you have the government borrowing trillions and you have the private sector, businesses, not just the consumer, but businesses borrowing, it does have upward pressure on interest rates. Higher pressure on interest rate raises the cost of capital, your old business people perhaps, and when you raise the cost of capital, you decrease investment that otherwise would increase productivity in the economy, and therefore you shrink the economy. Now, it's the thing about economics, the laws are pretty firm. The timing is what you can never figure out. And so what happens is you don't see this right away. You don't see the effects of the higher cost of capital immediately. It's insidious. It's slow and deliberate, and over a period of time, a 25 basis point reduction in the growth of the economy, the real economy, is several hundred billions of dollars over one generation. So you feel it only slowly, and that's what you want to avoid. And you have to think ahead, and that's why town hall meetings, I think, across the country about the deficit would be a very, very useful thing. You get a lot of backlash, but it's time to begin to talk about it.
I'm again trying to answer about three or four of you that ask a similar question, and that regards the $1 trillion of support for the mortgage market and that the Fed has given, and the current expiration date is March 31st of this year. What happens?
It ends. Now, the hard part, what happens next after that? Well, let's first of all, it's a very good question. The Federal Reserve has announced that at the end of March, now it's going to taper off. We're not buying this much and then it ends. We're tapering it down. We have been the market. That's not good. The Federal Reserve should not be a GSE. You got Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Thank you very much. We should not be that. So we do need to get out of it. Now, I think that what this country does best is, under the right rules, the market will fill in. What's going to happen to spreads, what's going to happen are always legitimate questions, but the market will step in. Interest rates themselves are low. The mortgage, even with some of the increases, are still very reasonable. And so we need to allow the market. And the Federal Reserve should not be allocating credit. I mean, that's what it is. You're supporting a sector of the economy when you are the market in mortgages. And that is not healthy for the long-run effectiveness of an economy. Because what's next? What if we had an agricultural crisis again? Or what if we had an energy crisis again? The Federal Reserve should be making loans directly? No, that's what the intermediation process is about. And that's why I have said we need to have commercial banks do what they're supposed to do. Payment system and intermediaries, not traders for their own account gambling our money. And that's just the facts that we have to face. And they are in the best position to be the intermediary, whether it's housing or energy or agriculture or name it, small business. That's your role. That's the private sector's market role. We're there for monetary policy and, yes, managing crisis, but not for supporting every sector of the economy in the credit extensions.
You've touched on the subject of our next question. I have at least 6, 7, maybe 8 cards asking about Fannie and Freddie. Some think maybe it was part of the original problem of what happened to our markets. There are asks. One is, why not Fannie and Freddie as we look at what's going on today? Sure. Is it expanding? what's going to happen to Fannie and Freddie. Is it going to be more regulated or less regulated? It's kind of a broad subject, and attack it however you would like to, Tom.
Well, I'm sure you don't have a hint of what I think about that, do you? Fannie and Freddie are government-sponsored enterprises that we were told, we, broadly speaking, would not be bailed out by the federal government. They were not insured. They were not guaranteed, except they were. And everyone knew that they were. And therefore, they had the ability to leverage and were encouraged to do so, and did so. And so they did contribute. Now, were they the cause? No. They were a contributor. The causes are many. The causes are an environment where we decided that, you know, we went from too much regulation to too little regulation. We went to subsidizing an industry, big time, the housing industry. And housing's important, but so is everything else. That's why you have. That's why you want a unbiased intermediary system. And we did. We biased it towards the housing market. We wanted everyone in homes. We thought renting was beneath us all. It's not. There are some people who are should be renters. Young people who haven't got the wealth yet, they're saving. They were put in these homes that they couldn't afford. So it's the thing about subsidies, they're designed to increase supply, and they do. And then you have the consequence because you allocate resources towards that beyond what's needed, and you get this. So we need to take a look at the GSEs. I don't know that we will. Housing is a very important sector in this country, and how everyone having a home is thought to be very important. But we need to look at it because if we're going to make the decision, and I think if it's made in the Congress, it's fine. If we're going to make that decision, then we have to be really ready to step up to the cost. And it's significant. And so that's the choice. There is no one thing in economics, students, that you learn early is there is no free lunch, not even today. I had to speak to get my lunch. So it's just the way it is. There's no free lunch.
Tin Staffel. We have several questions on the subject of the administration's announcement just this week about levying a tax on some large banks to help pay off TARP.
Right.
Your thoughts there, Tom?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that, like I said in my remarks, to micromanage the industry and to assess special taxes, the other rule and law of economics is the law of unintended consequences. So I don't know what, I can't anticipate all the consequences. But the worst thing is that what's got us here is too big to fail. These institutions, some of them would have survived, there's no question, and they would have survived on their own, would have gone through it, we wouldn't have these things, others wouldn't maybe not have. But by allowing and by stepping in necessarily at the time, because we didn't have a resolution mechanism in place, we're now getting the repercussions of that, the unintended consequences. And yet, you know, taxes, I understand it's an assessment for the losses they incurred. But it's not against the individual institution. I don't know how they're going to do it. I'm not sure of the details. We need to know all that before we make a judgment. But, of course, in the end, the consumer pays for all. And that's the way it's going to be. And so that's the choice that lies ahead. So I'm not necessarily opposed if that's what we need to do. But what I, you know, we're spending all this time and energy on, if you will, getting money back and so forth, I understand that, but not enough energy on ending too big to fail going forward so we don't repeat the past mistakes. That more than anything. Regulating bonuses, I mean, I just can't imagine the difficulty of that. And I would say if some of these institutions had in fact failed or been allowed to fail, bonuses wouldn't be an issue because they'd be on the street and not worried about whether they're justified in their bonus. So I don't know the answer to the question. I think the real answer is let's look forward and let's solve this problem. And that's what I'm focused on.
Two more questions, sure. But one, again, we have probably half a dozen of you. Oh, please keep in mind, I should have said this earlier, and I've avoided some questions that have asked for some type of projections on interest rates, because as an FOMC member, Tom could not comment on that. We do have several questions about inflation, the concern for inflation as we're pumping all this money in, and what's the Fed going to be able to do to try and take care of that delicate balance between some inflation, interest rates, and how it would affect the public.
Well, it's a very good question. It's the question for us, because as I said, we, as a policymaker in monetary policy, the actions we take today have their ultimate effect not only today, but several months from now, and perhaps several years from now. And so we have to be thinking about that. I do know that if we leave rates at near zero for name an indefinite period, that you will incite inflation at some point, or you will incite some kind of a bubble that you cannot anticipate. We realize that. So our challenge is this delicate challenge of not pulling it out so abruptly that you tank the economy and you cause people to become unsure and therefore pull back, but you not delay so long that you create the psychology of inflation and the psychology of speculation, and you give people the assurance that, yeah, this yield is permanent, therefore there is no risk, so I'll borrow short and lend long and create the next bubble. So that's the challenge. Now, there's real issues there. In 1937, those in monetary history know this, there was an enormous amount of excess reserves in the banking industry, and the Federal Reserve at that time was concerned about it because it could be brought onto the market. And so they increased reserve requirements, and the economy went into a major recession. Now, I tell people, yes, if you double the reserve requirements overnight, it's like putting an anvil on the economy. That's different than pulling it out gently, systematically, and causing the market to have to think about choices. That's a little different. And that's what we have to balance very carefully, because I tell people, if interest rates were 1% today, not very many people would say monetary policy is tight. And we're at zero. So we have a long ways to go before we're in that position. And in a speech I gave last week, I said, if on the long term, if we were back to our growth path, then nominal rates, policy rates that were somewhere between 3.5% and 4.5% would be reasonable. Now, I don't mean today. I don't even mean next month. But over the long term, to gently get ourselves there, but not so long that we create the next bubble. And that's judgment. I don't have a mathematical equation that solves that, and no one else does either. So that's what's tough about the future, and why individuals like myself and I think others have to be out trying to explain this, because it's not going to be necessarily popular either.
Okay, one last, I hope, fun, cute question. A number of years ago, I think Federal Reserve of Kansas City was criticized for having too clean a money. Do you have a comment, please? Have you corrected that problem?
Well, we have, we're a stubborn group in Kansas City, and so our money is as clean as it ever was, and we have fewer counterfeits than most other places of the country as well. So we're very proud of our record. Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Tom. I will see you next Friday for the celebration of the 25th anniversary, and 3 weeks from today for another luncheon.